Game On. On 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the Straight Talking Savings Bank.
Hello, you're very welcome to Game On here on 2FM. It's Hugh Cal with you until 8 o'clock tonight. We have all the latest with Nigel Pearson's sacking at Leicester City coming up in a few minutes' time. Paul Dunne is in studio after he booked his place at St Andrews yesterday with a brilliant performance in the qualifier. Graeme McDowell as well ahead of his title defence for the French Open, going for three in a row this weekend. Pete Carroll on Jose Aldo's withdrawal from UFC 189. And we have Jamie Conlon ahead of his big fight in Dublin on Saturday night. Text us in, as always, 51552. You can tweet at GameOn2FM. We'd love to hear from you between now and 8 o'clock if you have anything to say. You can take the piss out of Alan Cawley because he's back in studio.
Yes, Hugh, I'm back with a bang.
You're looking like one of those tangerine polished tomato heads.
I look well, don't I?
You look great, actually. Suits
it's
you
good
better
to be
than
back.
Suits me, anyway.
I missed you.
Did you really?
I miss you. Genuinely, did you?
What does that say about your relationship with your wife if you're missing me on holidays?
Ah, no, well, sure. She gets
Kathy
plenty of
would
me.
Be disgusted.
She gets plenty of me. She even says to me, one of the days you text me and she says, so what's your lover saying now? So I think she understands the relationship.
My radio wife, yeah. Listen, you had a good break. You're all refreshed. There's been a bit of news since you've been gone. I don't know if you've been keeping an eye on proceedings at Liverpool,
yeah.
But they've signed pretty much everybody in the entire planet.
I've seen that.
To try and get into Champions League spots for next season.
Decent signings as well, Hugh.
Are they though?
Yeah. I'm impressed with
Danny Ings.
Danny Ings has a lot of potential. I think he'll do okay.
Really?
Yeah.
Nathaniel Klein, another Southampton flop.
you can't call him that. I think Klein's a good signing. And I think Milner's a good sign as well.
What do you think of it is about Brendan Rodgers and Southampton, though? He spent 60 million on Southampton players, none of which so far have worked a jot.
No, I think Lallana will be a lot better this year. He has a year under his belt now with obviously a huge club at Liverpool.
Well,
I think
he's Steven Gerrard's replacement, so he'd want to pick up his socks.
I don't think anyone can replace him, to be fair.
No.
But, I think it's decent business by Rodgers, in fairness.
Yeah, no, and in fairness, they've acted before everybody else has come in.
Yeah.
So they've managed to actually tie up all these signings before
Plus
the money goes nuts and under the pressure to meet that deadline as well.
Yeah, and they're in a different market as well, Hugh, because obviously, once you're out of the Champions League, they're not going for the big superstar names that because they won't get them because they all want to play in the Champions League. So I think these fellas, established Premiership players, James Milner, obviously lots of experience. Can play in a couple of positions as well. Never let anyone down, any club he's been at. I think Milner will be good signing. And
you see, I'm not convinced. You see, I think Liverpool, if they've any aspirations about getting back to where they once were, which is a top force in England, a top force in Europe, and to win the Champions League again or to win the Premier League again would be a good start. I think they have to aim higher. And I think they have to be able to persuade these types of players to come and say, look, come with us for one season. You might be playing Champions football, but I promise you, we're building a squad. This is our plan. Like these kind of journeymen from Southampton, I'm just not convinced.
Nathaniel Klein is not a journeyman. He's only starting off his career. That's a bit harsh on poor Nathaniel.
12
take
million.
Take it back.
Yeah, I don't know.
No, I hear what you're saying, but they're in a totally different market now, Hugh. Like, when you think, obviously, City, Chelsea, and the money that they spend and the names and the players that they can attract, Liverpool are just not in that market. Liverpool, I'm afraid to say, are down in Aldi while all these boys.
Listen, you're a United fan. You can stop. What did you make of Nigel Pearson's sacking in Leicester City? We're going to talk about this with Rob Tanner in just a second, but can I ask you your opinion?
Yeah, I was shocked, to be fair. Not so much. If it had to happen with about 10 games to go, I wouldn't have been one bit shocked because obviously they weren't doing so well.
Sure.
But when you think of the miracle that he pulled off really and keeping them up because no one gave them a prayer. But some of the other antics that were obviously outside that.
Then his son went off to Thailand and made a sex tape.
Yeah, exactly. Which
goodbye
was the final nail in the coffin, I think. So obviously once they sacked him, that obviously played a huge part as well. But I was surprised based on what he had done keeping them up because that was a fantastic achievement as we've all
said. 7 wins in the last 9 Premier League games. I'm joined on the line by chief football writer with the Leicester Mercury, Rob Tanner. You're very welcome, Rob.
Good evening.
Listen, we've been having our 2 cents worth. None of it really matters, though, because you have the real story. What did you make, first of all, of Leicester's decision to sack Nigel Pearson?
Well, the timing of it is quite bizarre. It's 2 weeks since those three lads were sacked. So if it was an issue, which we understand it is, over his son, Nigel's defence of his son, why is it taking this long to manifest itself into his departure? I mean, it's obviously nothing to do with football. His record at Leicester City is, statistically speaking, the most successful manager the club's had. He's won nearly 50% of his games, and he's led them to 2 championships, League One and the Championship, to take them into Premier League. And, of course, he eclipsed all that with the greatest of great escapes last season. So the timing of it is very, very, very strange.
Yeah, I mean, he's had his share of run-ins, obviously, over the last few months with some players from opposing teams, and then obviously with the press itself. And, you know, outside of Leicester, you question how popular he was as a manager, but that didn't really matter because obviously he was doing the business on the pitch at the time. Is there external factors, do you think, specifically with his son, at play here?
I think it's a culmination of the incidents at the season, although some of them I thought were blown a little bit out of proportion. With the James McArthur incident, for example, that was a playful squeeze of his throat, shall we say, when he was lying down on the ground. I mean, I know Nigel, I wouldn't say I know him very well because he keeps the media at arm's length. You know, he lets you see what he wants you to see. But I obviously talked to a lot of people that know him very well, and he's got a very playful sense of humour. One of the things he will do with Alan Burton of the club ambassador is shake his hand and then give it one of these squeezes, which almost folds his hand in half, and that's his sense of humour. So when McArthur was on the ground, it started off as a joke. McArthur didn't realise it was a joke, said something to Nigel, and that's when Nigel grabbed his shirt and wouldn't let him go. But it was all diffused afterwards, and I thought that was blown out of proportion. But there were other incidents that were certainly of a concern to the board. They're obviously from Thailand. They hold respect and image very, very highly. And I think it all culminated in the incident in Thailand. And I think that was really the final straw for them.
I know his son was dropped from the panel and actually just, you know, was let go from the club because of that. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how much his paternal instinct kicked in and tried to stand up. And maybe, you know, because of that conflict, then the owners, being from Thailand themselves, just found the situation untenable.
I think you hit the nail on the head there. Obviously, he wouldn't condone his son's behaviour because it was quite shocking, quite appalling. Didn't do the club any favours whatsoever, and certainly insulted, you know, the whole of the nation. And they're very proud that they've got a Premier League football club owned by Thai people.
Yeah.
But also, you know, he is a father, and his son he's still a very young man. He's learned from his mistakes, and I would imagine Nigel tried to defend him in a meeting, and he probably did it in a rather bombastic manner, which is his nature. Mm-hmm. And that got construed as, he doesn't take this seriously enough. We can't work with him anymore. It's no longer viable.
What has been the reaction of the Leicester City fans?
Oh, they're in shock, and even when they were bottom of the table for nearly 5 months and 7 points adrift to safety. Although there was a little pocket of fans that thought a change was needed, it never manifested itself in the stadium. They stuck right behind the team, the players. I kept believing. And obviously, he turned it around and pulled them through. So they're really questioning the board now and the ownership for the first time in the 5 years they've been running Leicester City. You know, everything they've done has been positive. They wrote off over £100 million worth of debt. They've got the club into the Premier League. And this is the first time the fans now are thinking, hang on a second, have you made the right decision?
And that's, they're perfectly within their rights to question the decision, given his form. I suppose question now turns to who's going to take over, and are there any early candidates, and do you think that the board perhaps had somebody in mind before they made this decision?
Well, I did. I thought as soon as the press release came out, because it took everybody by surprise. Nobody in the media saw this coming. The only people that did were the bookmakers 15 minutes before the announcement was made, who suddenly slashed the odds on him being the first one to be sacked. So obviously they had a little bit of an inside tip there, so always watch the bookmakers. But I initially thought they've got somebody lined up. These are businessmen who have got billions in the bank from thinking two or three moves ahead. So when you sack a manager, a successful manager and a popular manager, you'd think that they've got another move in front of that, but it doesn't appear to be the case from what I'm being told. So they're starting very much from square one in terms of their recruitment. And again, there's no real outright candidate at the moment. There's a lot of names being bandied around, but mostly by the bookmakers, again, on what they've got on the shortest odds. But we'll see what they come up with.
The Irish Independent had a story today suggesting Martin O'Neill has been tapped up to go back to his old club. I don't know what you know about that or what your opinion is about the likelihood of that happening.
Well, Martin's been approached before in the past when there's been a vacancy at Leicester City, and he's always said no. He's got a legacy at the club. He's a bit of a Leicester City legend from what he achieved there in the past. And I think there was an element that he didn't want to go back and ruin that legacy. But at the time, obviously, stock was quite high. Now it's not really going that well for him as a Republic final manager.
That's pretty well put, Paul. That's pretty.
So, you know, perhaps the timing is probably the best now than it's ever been since he left the club.
Okay. Well, look, it'll be interesting to see who does take over. But thanks so much for filling us in, Rob. We really appreciate your time.
No problem.
Cheers. That's Rob Tanner there, chief football writer with the Leicester Mercury on that. I mean, Martin O'Neill back to Leicester?
They can have him. We don't want him anymore.
51552 for your text. Let us know what you think about that. Okay, we're going to move on because Irish amateur golfer Paul Dunne secured his place at the 144th British Open by winning the final qualifying tournament at Woburn Golf Club yesterday. It's the second year in a row he'll compete in that major tournament. I'm delighted to say that Paul and his coach Carl Holmes from Greystones join us in studio now. You're very welcome, Paul.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
No, it's great to have you back. Look, it wasn't so long ago that you were sitting here just after coming back from the States, and we were kind of wondering what your plans were for the summer. This obviously had to be a serious goal of yours, qualifying for the Open.
Yeah, well, obviously I left the few days after the Brabazon Trophy last week Open to go qualifying again, and I was meant to have, I think, a 3-week break after next week in Sweden. So I think it'll just be a 2-week break now, which I'll be okay with.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was obviously a goal, but it's hard to put it down in your calendar when only 3 people get through out of, I think, 72. So obviously it's a dream to go play the Open in St Andrews, and hopefully I can make the most of it.
3 out of 72 qualifying. Retief Goosen up there, Colin Montgomery, to name just 2, and plenty more players, seasoned challenge players, trying to get on as well. And how are you feeling stepping up? Obviously because of what you did last year, and you know the course a little bit better. Were you nervous or were you okay?
Yeah, I was a lot more nervous this year than I was last year. Last year I went out and kind of just freewheeled it. I didn't really know what to expect. I just went and played, and I played great and got through. This year, it's not that I thought I was better than the people that were playing, obviously, because they're all great players. I was looking at it more out of a score perspective. I was looking at 6-under getting through last year, and I just knew I was playing well enough to shoot 6-under, regardless of who was playing. So I kind of, in a weird way, expected to get through.
That's a brilliant philosophy to have going in. Forget about who's playing. I know if I shoot 6-under, it leaves it completely up to yourself then.
Yeah, because I didn't really want to look at the names, because, you know, it's just golf at the end of the day. Everyone has to put a score on the board. So I was thinking if I could just go out and shoot the scores that I knew I could shoot, because I was playing pretty well going into it, that I'd have a good chance. So I'm not sure I expected to get through, but I expected to be in with a chance. So because of that, I probably felt a little bit more pressure starting it, and I got off to a bit of a nervy start. But yeah, once I settled in,
How did you feel after that 2-footer went by on the hem, which was your first hole?
Yeah, I hit a good tee shot down there and kind of hit, I don't know, a little bit of a nervy wedge shot, spun off the front of the green, chipped it up to about 2.5 feet, and then just straight yipped one.
So really?
Yeah.
God.
I think everyone's yipped one on the first hole before. So, I don't know. Yeah, I was 2 over after 8. And really wasn't looking like I was going to get through, but I knew I was comfortable on the golf course, and I knew if I just kind of cut out mistakes that I was going to make birdies along the way. And luckily I cut out most of the bogeys the rest of the day and managed to hold a few.
So you shoot 70 after that first round, and you come back in, you kind of have a look up and say, right, what's the target for the second round?
Yeah, well, I birdied my last 3 in the first round to kind of salvage a good round out of really mediocre one. So
okay,
that gave me a little bit of a boost, especially birding the 9th hole as the last hole of my day. It was quite a tough one. And I looked at the leaderboard, and the scoring wasn't quite as good as I thought. I thought I'd be in about 10th, and I was in 4th. So I was just 1 shot outside the number. So I knew I was at 2-under. I knew if I shot 5 in the afternoon, I thought I'd gain automatically. And if I shot 4, I might be in a playoff. So
okay,
I just went out trying to... I knew if I cut out the bogeys that I was going to make 4 or 5 birdies anyway, because there was just a few holes in the course just set up nicely for me. So
brilliant, yeah.
I just went out with the attitude to just try play pretty simple golf and see how many under I could shoot.
But it's not a simple game, Paul. You know that. I know that. Everybody who's ever played golf knows that. To do what you did in the second round as well. I mean, as I said, you not only qualified, you blew the course away and blew everyone else away, and you were comfortable in the end. 9-under par total.
Yeah, it might have looked comfortable. It didn't feel quite as comfortable. But, yeah, I tried to simplify it as much as possible. Just trying to play every hole as I'd kind of planned out to play it. And I got to, I think I was playing 13, I think, at three under for the day, yeah. So I was 5 under total. I remember walking down the fairway saying to Dad, I said, could you imagine we were watching the Open here in St. Andrews in a few weeks and someone said, if you go out and play 6 holes now and play them at 2 under, you get to play. So that kind of excited me to play the last few holes, you know, and then I hit a few good shots in and managed to make the birdie putts.
So how do you feel walking off the 18?
I felt pretty good. I knew I had to bogey the last to get in, and I hit the worst tee shot I hit all day, and I managed to hit a tree and kind of ricochet back in the fairway, but it was only about 150 yards off the tee. So I had like 214 yards in when I should have had about 90.
So what did you hit? What club did you hit?
I hit 5 iron into it. I just wanted to get it somewhere around the green, so I managed to hit it about 10 feet and make it. But it was, yeah, it was a bit of a heart in your mouth moment when I hit the tee shot in the last. I was thinking, just what are you doing?
Man.
But apart from that, it was quite controlled.
Carl, I want to bring you in here because you know Paul a long, long time. Just take us back before we go into what he's just done. But when he was a kid, you would have spotted something about Paul that maybe kind of resonated with you. What was it?
I suppose when you're around junior golf, you know, around the club a lot, and you see a lot of juniors, you know, there was always something, whatever the X factor, whatever it is.
Yeah.
I think that was the best thing when it was Alan Murray, who was looked after Paul when he was in Alabama, was home a number, and he said, whatever it is, Paul has it. And you know, it's the one thing you can't describe it. Most of elite sports people, it's
is it more an attitude, do you think, maybe?
I think there's a number of things. Definitely people go on a lot about hard work, and it's probably, but I mean, I think that's the biggest thing that Paul has, and when you're around the club and you see the work and the time and the effort that he's put in over, you know, I mean, everyone will, it's the last 12 years of, you know, to get to the point he's at now, and it's not letting up, you know. And like you said, golf's a very difficult game, and it can wreck your head, as we both know.
Well,
me better than most.
Well, I won't argue with that one.
But you know, I think it's great now. He's obviously playing great golf, and he's on a high. But I mean, you know, golf is, you've got to have a fairly you know, relaxed view of it. You got to take the rough with the smooth, because it is that, you know, you ride the wave when it's going well, and not get too down on yourself. And I think that's the thing with Paul, is that he's able to kind of stay with the, you know, he's very good at making plans and staying with the process and following that plan through, and not getting too high and not getting too low. I mean, I think that's his biggest attitude, you know, his biggest attribute, as well as obviously being hugely talented.
That's something that you would be first to admit, I think. I'm not putting words in your mouth, that perhaps you struggled with a little bit when you were going through the football system, that mental side of things.
Yeah, definitely. It was just a case of ability, thinking it was all about ability, and the other side of the game in terms of the dedication and in the gym and lifting weights and all that kind of stuff, that's what let me down, and I'm not afraid to say that's exactly what happened, because if it was all down to ability, I would have played in England no problem. But there's another million kids could probably give you the same argument, and it's no surprise the fellas who put in the hard work and the effort every day, they're the ones that eventually come through. And it's so refreshing even to hear Paul speak like that for one so young, as Carl said, that he's real composed and has plans in his head. Because did you think after shooting the 70 on the first day or the first round, because you said going into the tournament you thought in a weird kind of way, I'm going to qualify here. So did you think after the 70, were you still in that kind of confident mood, or did it deflate you a little bit?
No, it didn't deflate me, because I obviously finished the round well, kind of gave me a bit of a boost. But I knew if I played as I expected myself to play, that I'd get to the number I needed to get to. I wasn't really thinking that I have to beat Goosen or Montgomery or any of those guys, because they had to go out and play as well. I was just thinking of score more than anything, that I needed to get to a certain number. And if I got to that, I'd get in. So I was just trying to do my own thing and see where it got me at the end of the day.
It's such a brilliant attitude to have, isn't it, Hugh? Because even the names you mentioned there, Goose and Montgomery, they're probably going in with a totally different mindset, you know, kind of worrying and putting pressure on themselves. And to hear such a relaxed attitude and kind of, and confident attitude as well, it's quite refreshing.
And maybe because it's St Andrews, maybe all those guys just wanted it that little bit more. That's the dream, really. I mean, the home of golf, I mean, it doesn't get better than that.
Yeah, obviously, I've played in St Andrews once in an amateur event, and the whole town is kind of a great atmosphere. It's all about golf, you know, so I don't really know how the atmosphere will be with an Open in St Andrews. I can't wait to find out. But I'm sure a few of those guys had played one before and wanted to get back, but I can't really speak for them on behalf of their attitude. But yeah, it was great though. When I was out there, I had, obviously Dad was caddy, and I had my brother out there and a few friends watching. So yeah, they made me laugh every time I made a birdie. They just started jumping up and down, making me jump. So kind of relaxed the atmosphere there a bit as well.
Yeah, I mean, what did you think, Carl, when you heard that he'd done it? Second in a row, by the way, yeah. Just for anyone who doesn't know.
I suppose, you know, it's no surprise. I mean, you know, it's not a shock that he did it, but it was funny because, you know, we were watching it on the internet, you know, all day, and it takes a while to update. So we're all guessing about what the number is, and, you know, everyone's kind of, Barry in the shop was, you know, Javier is a nervous wreck most of the time, so he's not going to do it, someone else. But so it took a while, and then, you know, we got the word that he was 9 under, like, because he went from, I think it was 6 was the last one that it showed, and then you went to 9.
Barry probably had a few quid on him to qualify. That's why he was they call him Dirk, by the way, in the shop. His track record is worse than yours, colleague.
but no, it was great. I mean, it's and I think, you know, I think this year, I mean, I haven't really asked Paul about it, but you know, the fact that he's had the whole experience of Hoylake last year, I mean, it's such a massive tournament to play your first professional event. At least, you know, he'll know what to expect this year a little bit more, and he'll probably be a little bit more comfortable in the surroundings, and so that can only help, you know. It's only going to help him, and hopefully the putter will be as hot as it is at the minute.
Well, will it help you, do you think? I mean, there is that thing, you've been there before, so you know what to expect, but equally then, maybe you, as with qualifying, you put that little bit more pressure on yourself. Because you have done it before.
Yeah, well, last year I really didn't know what to expect, and I just went in and played, and it was new feelings for me, you know, playing in front of so many people on such a big stage. So I think that'll help me. But having said that, I still only played one, so I can't really say. I can only tell you after I played the second one if the first one helped me or not.
Okay.
Hopefully it will. But it's all down to how you play. I think last year I was just excited to play, and I was... I don't know, I was going out, I was a little bit overwhelmed by the whole thing, and I kind of forgot to work on my game enough going into it. Well, obviously, I played the week before in the European Championships, like I will next week, but I was just kind of playing the practice rounds, looking at the course, instead of actually worrying about how I was playing. So I learned that from it, and so over the next week or 2 weeks, I have a better idea of where my game is and what I need to improve before then, or what I need to tighten up. So hopefully that'll help, but you know how golf is. I mean, every day is different. So hopefully I just get a good day, or a good 4 days that week.
We've had a text in. 51552 is the number, by the way, from Shane O'Connor. I think you know who that is. Can you ask Paul who his inspiration is and what drives him to be the great player that he is?
Well,
it's not Shane anyway. We can cut him out, the old hurler with the hacker.
I wouldn't say I have one main inspiration. Obviously, my idol growing up was Tiger Woods, like 99% of every other junior golfer out there.
Sure.
That's around my age. But I'd say I look up to different people for different things. In terms of what drives me, probably there's always somewhere to go from where you are. So when I was playing like under 15 stuff, you wanted to make the under 18 team. And then you wanted to win like the Irish under 18s. And then you want to make the senior team. So you make the senior team. Then I went off to college, and you want to like get some like awards, like All-American accolades and stuff like that in college. And I guess now I'm going to turn pro at the end of the year, so I'm looking to try and make Walker Cup at the end of the year, and then get through and have success as a pro. So I guess there's always a step further to go everywhere I've been so far, so that's probably what drives me.
This result must make Walker Cup selection, well, it's certainly not going to do you any harm anyway. I'm not going to put the markers on it, but it's certainly not going to do you any harm whatsoever.
Yeah, I don't think it'll hurt my chances, but no. I can't speak for the selectors, so sure. Hopefully.
You spoke, Paul, there about being nervous, say, playing last year. Does any of the other senior Irish players, say the Harringtons or even McElroys or any of these lads, obviously knowing that it's your first one and a young Irish lad, would any of them kind of come up and give you words of encouragement or what to expect?
Yeah, well, I played with Graham last year, Graham McDowell. He obviously went to the same college in America as I did, UAB, and played a practice round with him. You know, he was great, treated me well. I played a couple times when he was an amateur with Shane Lowry as well, and he's been brilliant. He's I played a few practice rounds with him. He's really easy to be around. Obviously, I think everyone in Ireland loves Shane.
Oh yeah, he's great. How could you not?
And he's met with every amateur's parents. He's given them advice about turning pro and everything. So he's been an absolute massive help. And so yeah, I might play a couple of practice rounds with him again this year, hopefully. And
speaking of Graham McDowell, he is teeing off tomorrow to defend his title for the second time. He's going for 3 in a row in the French Open. And he's been talking to Nick Dye about this, and also the impact that his family... Just, I asked you, was your dad going to caddy free at the Open? This is Graham McDowell, whose wife and baby are on tour with him now, and the impact that it's having on his golf game. You might want to have a listen to this.
I've always enjoyed the golf course. You know, I've been coming here for the best part of 12 years, probably. And, you know, even before I won here, I felt like this was a golf course that I could get it round. Sort of appealed to my sort of driving accuracy. Par 3 scoring's really tough here. Just a really tough golf course, you know, very linksy, firm, fast, sort of some roll-offs on the greens and stuff. But no, just a golf course I've always enjoyed playing. It's tough, and you really have to do everything well here. So nice to have won here the last couple of years, and exciting to come in here looking for a third.
When your game is developing, as it is, and there have been signs of a nice recovery, is this the sort of place that adds the confidence because you know just how to get it around?
I think so. I think, you know, coming here and not being worried about sort of tee to green, you know, I know my strategy here. I know what I've got to do, and it's just a case of, you know, having my game polished up and get the confidence going, really, you know. So I think, you know, if I'm ever looking for a little of injection and belief or confidence, I think coming to a golf course where I've won the previous 2 years is just what I need. You know, I felt like I had some momentum building, sort of Wentworth and Irish Open, and you know, I had a little knock to that confidence. You know, not feeling well at Memphis, and then carrying that hangover into the Chambers Bay a little bit and getting beat up there for a couple of days. But it's close, and I know it's close, and trying to be very patient, and certainly no panic going on. I'm enjoying what I'm doing, and I'm looking forward to being back on leaderboards.
Well, I imagine you'll play this down, but what are the thoughts on achieving 3 in a row at this event?
I mean, I think there's probably several players here who are going to have something to say about that, but that would be awesome to do. You know, it would be incredible. I think I read there's 5 players in the European Tour have done it already, so I can't believe 5 guys have already done this. That's pretty amazing. But you know, I think to have that opportunity is a lot of fun, and you know, I'll be preparing the way I always do. Just try and go out there and enjoy this golf course and see what happens.
Well, I take your preparations are a little different to what they might normally be because you've got the family with you, and that's a first, isn't it, on the European Tour like this?
Yeah, definitely. First time with a wife and kids over this side of the pond, and you know, we're in Ireland for a couple of days, enjoying some Irish hospitality with the family, and great to have them here. They're in Paris today, sightseeing a little bit, and no, it's exciting. It's different. Traveling as a family is very difficult. It's a lot of fun though, and it's nice to have some smiling faces waiting for me when I go back in the evenings.
Has your approach changed as a result?
I think so. I think there's no doubt my approach has changed a little this year. I think it's, you know, my game has suffered maybe because of it. You know, I'm enjoying life off the course a little too much. You know, priorities changed, time demands changed, the things you want to do change, and you know, you certainly have to reassess and reevaluate, and you know, playing golf is what I love to do, and winning tournaments is what I want to do. So, you know, you have to adapt, and you know, I've been going through that process. So it's been a lot of fun, and like I say, comes with a certain level of frustration with the game, but I wouldn't change it for the world. You know, I'm looking forward to being, you know, back on leaderboard soon. I've been working hard, and you know, I want it as badly as ever.
Graham McDowell there speaking to Nick Dye. There you have it. Marriage is bad for your golf game. Simple as that.
Kathleen, if you're listening.
That's my excuse. Just ask Gary Murphy as well. listen, it's been brilliant to have you in. It'd be fantastic to see you go well at the Open, but regardless, I mean, setting off on your career, about to turn professional, 2 Opens in a row, that shows, above anything else, that you belong with the top players in the world, I think.
Well, hopefully. I'll tell you in a few years for sure. But
make sure you keep coming back to see us.
Yeah, there's a lot of golf to be played until then, and yeah, golf ball doesn't know who you are, so I'm just going to keep working away at it and see where it takes me.
I love that. And by the way, Carl, you can bump your fee for lessons up by what, 30% now on the back of this? Maybe 35%?
A few of the guys that'll
bump it back down. Listen, Carl Holmes, professional Greystones Golf Club, and Paul Dunn, thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Cheers, guys.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight talking savings bank.
You're very welcome back. Now, Wimbledon continued today in what was described as the hottest July day ever recorded at the tournament. Novak Djokovic booked his place in the next round with a pretty comfortable win overall, but he did speak about how tough it was playing in the conditions today. Have a listen to this.
It was very solid. I thought I did well all three sets. Beginning of the match, he just came out firing some incredible shots. He made, I think, four winners first game, four or five winners second game. So it was a breakup, but I managed to regroup, play some good tennis, and get the control on my side. And this warm day, it's good to spend a little bit less time than maybe that it's possible. So I'm glad with the way I'm playing. I'm getting into the form as the tournament progresses. Hopefully, I'll be able to elevate my level of performance in the next one.
Novak Djokovic, I should say. Now, Barry Flatman from the Sunday Times is on the line to talk a bit more about this. Hiya, Barry.
Good evening.
It's good to talk to you. Listen, before we get into some of the action from today, there has been some controversy, I suppose, about the men's and women's tournaments in relation to the heat. Now, can you just take us through what exactly the difference is at the moment for the women's game and the men's game, as you see it?
Well, there is a thing in action, or potentially in action, called the Wimbledon heat rule, which means when the temperature tops a certain level, 31 degrees Celsius, the women players can go off for a 10-minute rest and recuperation in between the second and final set. However, in this age of equal prize money and everything like that, the men aren't allowed to do so. And one or two people think that that's somewhat strange.
I mean, somewhat strange would be very mild if you ask me. When you consider that the men play five sets of tennis versus three for the women, as you said, prize money is equal and everything is great. Apart from this, it seems absolutely crazy to me that the men aren't afforded the same break.
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree with you more. Let's be honest here. Yes, it was very hot today. But the temperatures today didn't really rival some of the brutal temperatures of 40 degrees plus that you can get at the Australian Open when players are, frankly, in danger. Hmm. Tennis is supposed to be a summer game. This is tennis as it was meant to be, lawn tennis on grass, which doesn't have the same heat coming up through the court as a hard court would have. So the players are all, hopefully, all sufficiently fit to withstand these kinds of things. They do their warm weather country training. Roger Federer, goes to practice in Dubai. Novak Djokovic goes to Abu Dhabi. They're all conditioned for this kind of thing. Andy Murray, Miami, of course. So I think rather too much fuss was being made out of it. The people that were more at danger, quite frankly, were the spectators. And that was where the St. John's Ambulance Brigade were a little busy today. But certainly, we've had no reports of players suffering from heat exhaustion or anything like that.
I know Maria Sharapova had to come out, well, didn't have to, but she chose to defend the WTA heat rule earlier this week, saying, you know, if it does get quite hot for us, we're able to use it, then why not? And that's absolutely fair. But what's not fair is that it doesn't apply to both the men's and women's tournament. And surely this is just, you know, basic logic at the end of the day that somebody needs to have a look at this, Barry.
Well, yes, I couldn't agree with you more. The trouble is that there's one or two rules that need a bit of looking at in tennis at the moment, and nobody seems to be looking too hard. So much fuss is made about the time being wasted in between points. With players like Rafa Nadal, they're supposed to be, play is supposed to be continuous and it's supposed to be no more than 25 seconds between points. Rafa Nadal goes beyond that, I would say, 9 times out of 10. He occasionally gets a warning, it never goes any further than that. Some people say they ought to have a shot clock on the side of the court where it ticks down to the allotted time. I don't know about that, but I just think if you're going to have a rule, then use it. if you're not going to use it, then just forget about it.
That's interesting on the shot clock. I mean, that would solve a lot of problems. I know Djokovic as well has been guilty in the past. He takes his bounces, if you like, before the serve, and you know he's not the quickest player ever. But yeah, I mean, is there anything else that you've spotted perhaps that would need attention?
Well, the misuse of medical timeouts. That is probably the worst thing in the game at the moment. You know, a couple of years ago in the Australian Open, Victoria Azarenka, who went on to win the title, maintained that she went off for a medical timeout because she'd lost her nerve a little bit. She was getting anxious. Well, you know, that's all part of the game, isn't it? You know, yeah. I think she wasn't injured. And if players aren't carrying an injury, then they shouldn't resort to these medical timeouts just to regroup mentally.
What about Heather Watson, Barry? What can you tell us about her, the British number one? She's causing quite a bit of a stir over there at the moment. A brilliant win today against, I think, Tatiana Halytova, was it?
Yeah, that's right. A far more experienced player. Heather was determined to do well going into this tournament. She's had a bit of an up-and-down year. She won a tournament in Hobart early on in the year, just before the Australian Open, and then lost first round in the Australian Open, and hasn't really set the world on fire since. But she knows Wimbledon. She feeds off the British support, and she played exceptionally well against Handicova, who's a player of considerable experience. And all things being equal now, it will be Serena Williams in the next round. Serena's a set to the good against Tamira Babos of Hungary as we speak. Everything looks to be going to plan. It'll be a big show court. It'll be a big occasion. And let's hope that Heather Watson is up to that.
Brilliant. Okay, look, thanks so much for your time, Barry. We'll let you get back to it. We appreciate you, though. Thanks many for coming on.
It's a pleasure.
Cheers. Barry Flatman there from the Sunday Times. Yeah, it's hot, but as one text says, it's hot at the US Open. What's the big deal? Yeah, same for Australia. I understand that. I suppose just in terms of the differential between the men's and the women's game, in terms of that 10-minute break rule, does seem a bit batty to me. Anyway, we're going to move on because Irish MMA journalist Pete Carroll is on the line. Hiya, Pete. How are you?
How are you doing, you?
Good, thanks. Yeah, now look, it's not the news that Irish MMA fans would have wanted, indeed, I suppose, anywhere around the world planning to watch or go to this fight, but at least there is a fight taking place in Las Vegas.
Yeah, it's the interim title, and really, you know, the interim title is kind of pulled out when they kind of need to keep the marketing there for an event. Obviously, it can be brought out if a champion hasn't defended this title in about, you know, a year and a half to 2 years, but in this case, Dana White has cited the fact that Aldo has missed 5 title defenses. This is the 5th time he's withdrawn from a title bout. So he thinks that's grounds enough to let McGregor and Mendez meet for the interim title. And I think that's fair enough, I suppose.
Yeah, okay. Well, so let's just go back a bit because, you know, first of all, we had the problem with this drug test that didn't take place or that was a problem over. Then we had a situation where, obviously, in training, the rib was done and we weren't sure the extent of the damage. And then we're here that, you know, it was bruised, but Aldo was okay to fight and now he's not okay to fight. It's been a bit of a messy build-up over the last 3 or 4 weeks and people are getting a little bit frustrated by that.
Yeah, definitely, you know, and the conspiracy theories are coming in thick and fast, you know, a lot of people are saying Aldo pulled out, you know, this botched drug test, they're kind of saying it's a reason for him to get away with it, they think he's been taking something. Other people think, you know, it was a rib injury. UFC wanted to keep the fight going because they'd invested so much money in it, they cleared the rib. Aldo's Brazilian doctor said, no, it was in fact broken. And you know, as you know yourself, rib injuries are so painful, even if it was a bruised rib. Extremely painful injury, and that's the reason why he's pulled out. And you know, I think I'm on that side of it. You know, I think Aldo's pulled out because he's genuinely injured. I think there was so much money involved in this fight for him. They're talking millions. Mm. He's never had anything like that, any type of purse of that quantity available until before. So I think he would have fought if he could have.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty logical, really, when you consider the amount of money is involved. Okay, so look, Aldo's gone. There's no point crying over spilled milk as such. So tell me, how good is Chad Mendes for people who mightn't have seen him fight before?
Well, Chad Mendes is the guy that people are saying should be in front of McGregor. You know, his only 2 losses in his career have come to Jose Aldo. His first one was a first round KO. The second one was probably one of the best back and forth bouts I've ever seen in my life. It took place last October 2014, and they were literally, they sat in the pocket with each other. It was an amazing fight. One of the most electrifying fights I've ever watched on TV. But the thing with Mendez is, you know, he's developed this KO power in his hands. He has an amazing wrestling pedigree. He's a Division One A wrestler. You know, that's as high as it goes in America. That's as good as you can be. But, you know, we've seen him kind of use his hands a lot more, and he's shown some great knockout power. The reality of it is, there's no way Mendez would have got a bout with Aldo again if he wasn't in this situation. He's hit the gold rush. You know, he beats McGregor, he gets a third fight against Jose Aldo, you know, for the undisputed title. He's going to go in there, you know, all guns blazing. And he has said, you know, he believes he can knock out Conor just as much Conor believes he can knock out Mendez.
Do we have any idea how fit Mendez is, how much preparation he's been doing over the last few weeks, given that, you know, this has just been thrown upon him with, just over a week to go?
Yeah, well, I mean, Mendez and Frank Yeager, both of them said that they were going to stay ready for this fight because they knew of Aldo's history of pulling out bouts. I know guys do this all the time. You know, it's a reoccurring issue with MMA. It's such a highly, you know, contact sport. You know, there's a lot of contact going on in training even. So guys are always kind of staying ready, especially when it's for a featherweight title, especially when guys are actually saying you should be the one fighting for the title. Them guys knew what was coming. And I think Mendez was picked over Edgar because he has a bit of back and forth with McGregor. Edgar's more of a guy to sit back and just let his fights do the talking, but Mendez has tried to get in there and exchange words with McGregor, so it's a better sell to the fans on such a short notice.
Conor said this morning that it's irrelevant who he's facing. I mean, he doesn't visualise the opponent whatsoever. It's basically a fight against himself. So his training is not going to alter no matter who he's fighting. Do you believe him?
Yeah, well, you know, I was over there in the camp in the last week of May. I know that's a good bit out from the fight, but what I noticed was Conor's, even the way he's talking, it's like number one world champion. Jose Aldo doesn't really come into it for him. You know, I was there every day for a week. You know, I don't think you could keep up that act, you know.
Yeah.
But he said this to me 2 months ago when he was in LA. I was on the phone with him and I said, you know, do you think Aldo will make the fight? And he goes, if they don't, they'll give me an interim title fight anyway. I know they will. I'm going to be the champion. You know, that's just the way he is. You know, he always kind of gears himself towards, he prepares himself for every situation. But I personally think it's a massive risk he's taken, and I think he's taken it for the Irish fan. You know, I think if they weren't involved, I don't think Conor would have taken this fight. I think he would have postponed and went and fought Aldo in 7 weeks. You know, he is very loyal to his Irish sport, and he does understand the amount of money people have invested into this fight for him as well.
Yeah, but equally, I suppose, you can't say that you don't care who's in front of you and maintain that and then refuse a fight when an opponent changes. So I suppose he had to take the fight in that respect. And equally, you know, if you look on the upside for Conor here, he's got a massive payday coming up against Chad Mendes and a chance to, I suppose, silence any doubters that he might have risen up the ranks too quickly or pushed by Dana White in the UFC. And then, should he win that, he has the prospect of facing Jose Aldo when he's recovered.
Well, this is it, you know. If Conor went out and bet Jose Aldo, they would have said, well, how's he going to do against a wrestler? If he goes out and beat Mendez, a wrestler, they're going to say, oh, well, he hasn't bet Jose Aldo. So, I mean, it's not, you know, it was going to happen either way. I think he was going to come out with good questions to answer anyway. So, I mean, people are looking at this October date in Dublin as a potential time for Aldo to face McGregor, but I think that's pretty unrealistic. As much as I'd love that to happen, you know, They will be, I imagine they will be doing it, you know, in the American time zones in Vegas if they can, because, you know, fight capital of the world, it's perfect for them out there. Everything's kind of tuned towards an MMA broadcast like that.
Okay, just finally, Pete, I mean, you mentioned that the Dublin UFC event is scheduled for 24th, I think, of October in the Three Arena. So any idea of who we can expect with that, or is it too early to make predictions?
Well, really, you know, you can expect every Irish fighter to be on that card once they're this. You know,
yeah.
All the guys, everybody wants to be on it. But you see, the thing is, they're all, apart from Ash and Norman, I think they're all lined up for fights at the moment. That's Ash Daly and Norman Park. So it's really going to be, like, depending on what happens in Scotland and what happens in Vegas. You know, like, people like Neil Seary, Paddy Hewlin, they could be going on some of the most significant streaks in their divisions if they take wins in the next two bouts. So they could be huge fights going into Dublin. Carl Pender could be 5-0. Like, you're guaranteed a big fight if you're 5-0, really, in the UFC. You know what I mean? So there's a lot of interest in matches upstairs. I can't imagine Conor will be on the card, which will upset a lot of people. But really, UFC, you have to make make hay while the sun shines with McGregor. You know, he's over there in America, and you know, everybody wants to see this guy fighting. They're going to capitalize on that as much as they possibly can.
And they did promise after last time it wouldn't be long before he was back in Dublin. So look, I mean, we're waiting to see, but for the moment we have a fight anyway. At least we have an opponent, and it's all systems go. Thanks a million, Pete, for your time.
No worries, you. Talk to you again.
Okay, stay with us. We've got Jamie Connell coming up after the break. It's big fight Saturday night. Stay with us.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight talking savings bank.
Okay, you're very welcome back. Now, on Saturday, Jamie Connellan heads a brilliant night's boxing at the National Stadium in Dublin. The Belfast man takes on Junior Granados, where he puts his WBO super flyweight intercontinental title on the line. I'm delighted to say that Jamie joins us on the line now. How are you, Jamie?
Not bad. How's it going?
Not too bad. Listen, thanks a million for talking to us. Are you all set, ready to go?
Yeah, I'm as ready as you can be, knowing someone's going to try and take your head off on Saturday night. So put myself through hell and back over in Spain, so I'm ready to go.
Yeah, how have you found Marbella and the setup at Macklin's gym there? Because I know you moved kind of lock, stock and barrel for your training for the majority of over the last few weeks. So how has it been?
Yeah, it's been great. I went out in January and made sure that I got used to the surroundings before I actually started my own camp. So it wasn't strange to me. So when I went out and did my camp for this, I went out for 9 weeks straight and got used to everyone and it was a new way of life. But I relished it and I'm ready to go now from it.
Did you know any of the guys really before you went over there? Because I know you said it was quite like the high performance unit when you went out there to get to know them. So did you have any idea about the guys that would be there before you went out?
No, I knew one or two. I knew of them. I knew of Derry Matthews and I knew Peter McDonough throughout the years. But when I went out, I got introduced to everyone and I clicked immediately. And I was staying with the lads and it's just everyone's on the same page. We're all striving for the same goals. So it's good to have that kind of competitive around everyone. So it's good to have each other together.
And it was brilliant, obviously, that you managed to settle in so quickly. But how tough was it, your decision to kind of move on from John Breen, your former trainer? Was it a difficult decision for you?
Oh, it really was, because me and John Breen got on really well since I was 14, 15 maybe. Because my amateur club used to use his gym, so I knew John all my boxing career. I always looked up to John as when he had the pros. I used to go down and watch even when I was younger, watching McGee and all train and that kind of relationship I had with him grew. So the real age that I had to move on with my career and go to Marbella and set up and do everything without John was a tough decision to make, and took me a while to think about it and actually sit down and come to the agreement with myself that this is the right move for me and the right move forward.
Because you're
but it was one of I'm glad I made now, to be honest.
Yeah, I was just because I was looking at your record, obviously, and 13-0 is brilliant because you're undefeated. But equally, then if you consider the amount of time that you spent as a professional boxer, I was wondering, were you perhaps a little bit frustrated that there hadn't been more fights during that time, and maybe more opportunities to go for belts during your time with John?
Certainly, it was a mix of inactivity and injury and stuff like that that was kind of me leading me astray from boxing and going. I got a job and had to work, and it was kind of wee things like that that were putting me off boxing. But then when now I've got this opportunity and I've got this new lease of life, so to say, and the lads have given me the opportunity to grow as a fighter and better myself as a fighter, it's everything I need now. So it's right on track.
What about Danny Vaughan then, your new trainer? What did he do that perhaps was different than what you were doing before? Has he changed much about your style or the way you approach your fights?
My style would be probably the same, but he has got me doing things differently. I'm not as aggressive as I usually just normally come forward all the time. He's got me boxing a bit, but my style is what it is. He's just tinkered a wee bit and added a wee bit of different aspects to my game. So he's a great man to have around in the corner in sparring and stuff. You learn so much of him because he's very quiet. He only gives you one or two instructions every round, and he's also got me sparring using my brain, not going out and trying to kill people in sparring. It's good. He's given me a new aspect on the game.
So tell us about this guy, the Mexican, who's going to try and take your head off on Saturday night. What do you know about him?
Well, I just know he's a tough, I think he may be small, I'm not too sure on his height, but he's a tough come forward Mexican, former WBC Hispanic champion. He throws a good left hook into the body and left hook to the head. It's a typical Mexican shot. I think they're all taught in the womb, if I'm honest, because every single one of them throws it pretty well. But he's going to give me a lot of challenges. He's going to make for a very exciting fight because my style and his style will just gel, and we're going to meet in the center of the ring. I know Danny Vaughan has a plan of action that I have to follow by, but there will become times in this fight that it's going to be very explosive.
Okay, well, look, it should be a brilliant night. There's some really good Irish talent on the card, including Steve Collins Jr., of course, that we had on the show late last year. I presume Michael and your dad will be in your corner as well?
Well, my dad will, but Michael's actually away on holiday. He booked it before the WSB was over. He was, that's what his big worry was, I think. It wasn't not qualifying for the Olympics, was not being able to go on holiday if he didn't qualify.
Yeah,
so
okay.
So he's not going to be here, but my dad and Paddy Barnes are coming down for me, so one Belfast lad is better than two.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, with Paddy in your corner as well, he'll make up for Mick not being there. Listen, thanks
yeah,
to
many, James.
We wish you the best of luck. It's going to be a brilliant night. For anyone who wants to go along, you should be able to still get tickets or turn up even on the day. Thanks a million, Jamie, and best of luck on Saturday
thanks
night.
Thanks very much.
Super
yeah,
stuff.
Thanks very much.
Jamie Conlon there. Yeah, should be a cracking night. I'm planning to go myself.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight-talking savings bank.